That was a bit of last year's Oneida Nation Powwow, and we're exploring the Native American culture and tradition and what to expect at this year's powwow that starts today. It is Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. There is dancing, the rumbling of drums, a collective celebration of being connected to Native American heritage. A powwow is a social gathering for Native American tribes and each of the 11 federally recognized American Indian nations here in Wisconsin host powwows. Have you been to a powwow before? What do you love about these celebrations? Is it the music, the dancing, the food, the cultural exchange, or is it something else? We want to hear about your experiences and gather your questions. Join in at 800-642-1234. Art Skenendor is MC of the 47th annual Oneida Nation Powwow this weekend. He's also the principal and athletic director of Oneida Nation High School. Art, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
So the Oneida Nation's powwow, long, long tradition, almost 50 years old. Can you tell us about how this powwow got started?
Well, actually, there was a set of powwows that occurred in the community before the 47th annual. The 47th annual was the first one held on the grounds of the Norbert Hill Center.
Huh.
And so for the last 47 years, it started for the purposes of really celebrating our identity and bringing forth the relationship between all the tribes as well. And I'm going to date myself, but I remember that first powwow. And going forward to today, it continues to grow, it continues to thrive, and it continues to celebrate our family relationships and our relationships with the surrounding tribes of Wisconsin as well.
Well, as you date yourself, you must have been a very young person at that time when you saw your first powwow. What is it like for little ones who go to powwows and take that in, take that tradition in?
Well, it's really, when you look at our categories of dance, we for every powwow, we always honor what we call our tiny tot category, and those are the 5 years and younger. And it's really, at that point, it's really also honoring the parents, because the parents want to make sure that these young people begin their footsteps, we say, in the circle of this gathering. And so it's really about families coming together, making sure that if you were to walk around Oneida, you would find families that are preparing their tiny tots, getting ready for this gathering as well. So it's from, in our language, we call it Ladiksasun and Danu Ladikstahoko, from the youngest to the oldest. That's what we celebrate.
What tribes will be participating?
Last year, the last few years, I know there was over 20 to 30 different tribes coming from different areas. Because when you have a powwow like this, it really is also a signal for families to also call their families back to their community. So wherever they might be, you know, on any given weekend, a lot of families will come back just to celebrate family reunions as well. In this particular gathering, there's also a number of memorial dances for family members that have passed on. So it really becomes a real celebration of nations, what we call the Turtle Island, because we'll have tribes from California to Florida to First Nations territory in Canada to, you know, right downtown Oneida as well.
It kind of sounds like a coming home celebration in a way.
Absolutely.
We're learning about the Oneida Nation's powwow this weekend from Art Skenendor, the event's MC. We also want to hear from you. Are you taking part in the powwow's dance competition? Or perhaps you'll be singing or drumming? Are you planning to go to watch as a spectator? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Art, is this powwow a fundraiser in any way for the tribe? Does it help support programs or services?
Well, it does support programs and services, because it allows also, as I mentioned, it's a coming home opportunity, so we'll have many family reunions. So there's lots of craft stands. So it really creates the opportunity for the entrepreneur, the craft person, to celebrate their craft with all the people that come. Different families, for example, have food stands that they come together and support as a food vendor. So each one of those events in itself within those family units provides the support that the families share with each other. It might be for opportunities for the family to gather. It might be for special events. So it really is an opportunity to support. And we have informational booths, for example, of all the tribal nations services, the United Nations services that are also provided. And it gives everybody a snapshot because this is an event that's we welcome the public to come. It's an opportunity for everybody to visit, to share in that relationship, and really provide that good feeling of having that opportunity to come together around song and dance and food and relationship.
Can you tell us a little bit about the food, specifically fry bread?
Fry bread is one of those pieces of, I guess you could say, of tradition that every community has some version of fry bread. And for that opportunity, a lot of people come just for a meal. They have different corn soups. They have different types of fry bread with what they call fruit jams on top of them. Mm. They have some that are sprinkled with maple sugar. So if you're looking to enjoy a good meal on an afternoon, some people drive out just to come to the powwow just for that opportunity to enjoy that meal for the day. So we certainly invite everybody to come out and experience. And for those that that are just wanting to look at crafts, one of the there is a, I guess you could say, a row of craft stands behind the powwow that goes all the way around in a horseshoe.
Yeah.
And you can find just about any type of art and craft and paintings and clothing, anything that you're looking for, you can find at the United Nations Powwow.
Well, Art, we started by hearing a few seconds of drumming and singing from last year's powwow. How do drummers and singers work together? What is that like?
Well, when you think of a song, any type of song, there's always a verse and there's a chorus. And in our songs are no different. When you look at the songs that we use for these type of events, they're social songs. You look at every one of our drums, they're composers. When you think of the original music of this Western Hemisphere, there'll be songs with words in that tell a story. There'll be songs that are in some ways what you might call vocal. They're straight songs with no words but melody. But each one of those has a history to it. And sometimes you'll hear a song that you haven't heard in 20 years. Being around this circle for a while, in my own experience, I've learned from some of the best mentors in this circle in terms of singers. And so it really is a celebration of new songs, old songs, and it's dancing, provides the background for dancers to enjoy each other's company.
Art Skenendoer is MC of the 47th Annual Oneida Nation Powwow. We're learning about it. Gets underway today. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Have you been to a powwow? What is that experience like? What is memorable? We'll be back for more Wisconsin Weekend in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. That is sound from last year's Oneida Nation Powwow. We're learning about what to expect from this year's event. It gets underway today, runs through the weekend. I have vivid memories of attending powwows as a kid at the Minneapolis American Indian Center in the late 70s, early 80s. My dad took me, and he had a business near the center. I vividly recall the regalia, and I would stare wide-eyed in a corner of the gym just taking it all in because it touched all the senses. What do you remember from your very first powwow? How did it make you feel? Share your experience at 800-642-1234. Art Skenendoor stays with us. He is the master of ceremonies at this year's Oneida Nation Powwow, which starts today in Oneida, Wisconsin. So, Art, take us to the grand entry. You know, dancing is a big part of powwows. It starts with the grand entry. Tell us about that.
Well, there's lots of different stories about the origin of the grand entry. Some look back to the days of the first time that the rodeo shows, and they say that grand entry started there. But I had the opportunity to visit many years ago with a mentor of mine who shared the story that really when our tribal nations visited each other, they would always have protocol of walking. You know, they would address each other in such a way that they would come in to that visit of that nation. So it was very structured protocol of making sure that everybody said thank you to each other for being a part of each other's community. So the grand entry today is a kind of a part and parcel of all of those stories put together. But just as the words say, it's grand. It's all the categories, styles of dance, straight dance, cloth dance, fancy shawl dancing, fancy feather dancing, grass dancers, northern traditional, southern traditional dancers. And we invite them all in by ages, starting with our elders first and then working all the way to the tiny tots. So it really is the, I guess you could say, the parade of dancers, of all the styles of dance you'll see. For anybody coming to the powwow for the first time, it's absolutely the best time to come and enjoy. It takes about 45 minutes to an hour to bring all these dancers into the arena. We have a protocol of honoring our eagle staffs and our flags. We also have a song that we set aside just for the veterans. It opens up the arena for that opportunity. So that's the beginning protocol, but the grand entry, it all begins with that celebration of all those styles of dance and all these people coming to the community. The committee for Oneida, for example, will be handing out little bits of tobacco to say thank you for the dancers for bringing their style of dance to the arena. And they'll do that for each one, the community royalties that visit, as well as our own Miss Oneida and Junior Miss and Little Miss Oneida will be at the forefront of the grand entry. So it really is, just as it says, it's a grand opportunity for everyone to see all those styles of dance that they come into the arena for the first time.
And dances are divided between men's and women's. How are the styles of dance different?
Well, there's a lot of different styles in a powwow that you'll see throughout the weekend. On the women's side, there's a dance called the Women's Jingle Dance, which is original to this Great Lakes area. It's a traditional style of dance that has grown into a category of contest dancing. You'll see what's called the Women's Fancy Shawl Dance, which is really our contemporary very graceful style of dance that comes into the arena. All the young ladies that share that good style of dance, top-notch, physically fit, can rock and roll for every song that's put at them. And then we have also the most respected and honored category, which is the women's traditional category. Our elder women to our young women that are in that category are in the styles of buckskin and cloth. And their style of dance is a little slower, very respected style of dance throughout North America. And on the men's side, we have men's traditional dance. We have what's called men's grass dance, which is a warrior style of dance. You'll see a different style completely where they were the young warriors that would clear the area for the council meetings. And so they had a song for that. And they would you'll see them brush their style of dance is really they portray flattening out the grass so that people can sit and enjoy that console of each other. And then we also have what's known as the fancy feather dance, some call it ruffle dance as well, and that's the men's side, which is similar to the women's fancy shawl. It's the fast, very expressive style the most fit of our communities are in that category of dance. They're all young dancers, and they show their style. I shouldn't say all they're young, but majority are. And that fancy feather dance is one that showcases. We'll actually have a spotlight dance on Saturday night, where it's the men's fancy shawl versus the women's fancy shawl, men's fancy feather dancers versus women's fancy shawl dancers. It's a showcase event that everybody enjoys. Put the spotlight on them, and you'll see some of the best dancers of North America.
Talking with Art Skenendore, he is MC of the Oneida Nation's powwow this weekend. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with what questions you have about powwows. Art, can you tell us about the regalia and what the dancers wear and where this dress comes from?
Well, there's all these different styles of dance. There's different regalia that comes along with it. But I guess the primary one piece of regalia that is in both the men's and women's side and probably has the most honor and respect is the use of eagle feathers. And when we use these eagle feathers for this event, it's really about demonstrating our indigenous relationship with that natural world. And so when we use those eagle feathers, it's a reminder, we say, of this world that we're a part of is a part of that natural world. So we use, you know, for example, buckskin for some of the regalia that people wear, and the trade cloth that goes back to the treaty days. So you'll have some folks that'll be wearing cloth as well, and then all of the, of course, the beadwork is outstanding, and that is an incredible investment of time
and
craft by each individual. So when you look at one particular person in their regalia, you can celebrate with them the number of hours that it takes to sew those beads on to their regalia, to their fixing their eagle feathers in such a way that they create the bustle that shows that relationship to the natural world. Each one of them. I guess for anybody coming to the powwow for the first time, we certainly welcome you to enjoy looking at all of these styles of dance, and also to extend that respect and honor to all of those dancers for the hard work they put in to sharing their regalia with all of us as they dance.
Art, is there any etiquette you could help us with for people who have never attended a powwow?
Really, as an MC, that's part of our responsibility to make sure that we're out in front and being able to explain to people the different styles of dance, and if there's anything that is happening in the arena that requires, for example, that moment of respect where we might say we'd rather have you not use your camera right now. But it's really just about being respectful for the moment. And if there's ever a question that you have, that's all you have to do is ask. But usually as the MC, if there's ceremonial things that might be occurring in the arena, we will let everybody around the arena know that this is a moment, a respect moment, where we ask for no recorders or no cameras. But anything other than that, we certainly invite people to come and enjoy, listen to the songs, capture that moment with their, you know, used to be just the cameras, but now everybody has a smartphone, so it's your phone. Make sure you use it in the best way and most respectful way.
As we start to wrap up, are there other powwows this summer that people can check out?
Well, next weekend, for example, in Lac des Flambeaux is the Bear River powwow. Right after that is the Honor Earth powwow in Le Coup d'Oreil. And the weekend after that is a powwow up in Bad River. And then there's a powwow down in the Dells the last week of July. So you can actually go anywhere in Wisconsin, and there's at least two or three powwows going on any given weekend throughout the summer.
We're just about out of time, but I wanted to ask you, you've been to so many powwows over the decades. What is the most sacred moment for you in a powwow?
The most special moment for me is when you see your family enjoying that occasion, from the youngest to the oldest. And so I've had that opportunity. You mentioned that you were at American Indian Center.
Yeah.
Sounds like you were in there about the same time that I was. So when you look at family, it's really about enjoying those family moments. And so when you see that opportunity for people to come and you have your children sing or your children dance, and that circle is complete by that experience. And I've seen that so many times with families, that's really the highest moment of honor for me, is to see how that circle is closed by family. As
Art,
I said, the youngest to the oldest.
Art, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Art Skenendoor is Master of Ceremonies of the 47th Annual Oneida Nation Powwow. We have a link at WPR.org on the Morning Show page. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. On a Friday, you're with us for Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story for the summer concert season.
The Grateful Dead played at Alpine Valley Music Theater 20 times in the 1980s. Fans trucked to the southeastern Wisconsin venue from all over the country. Producer Steve Gotcher attended most of those shows. On the day that turned out to be their last concert at Alpine, in July of 89, he decided to record the sounds of the scene in the parking lot. Here's what he found.
When I was 25, I became a Deadhead, a fan of the Grateful Dead. Up until then, I couldn't understand what all the fuss was about. So my friend Kevin suggested that I come along with him to a show at Alpine Valley near Milwaukee. He claimed that once I saw a concert, I would understand. And he was right. So from July 1981 to July 1989, I made my way to that hillside for 19 concerts. In the early 80s, most of the people who showed up had a ticket, with a few looking for a miracle. What started out as a loopy, easygoing crowd who followed the band over the summer swelled over the years into a much larger bunch who just came to party.
What?
You know
how to make burgers.
It was the scene in the parking lot before and after the show that I found the most intriguing. So I decided to try and capture the setting on tape, wandering around the dusty parking area with my portable cassette recorder.
Morning.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay, how you doing?
All right.
What you doing?
Making a tape for a public radio documentary.
Oh, really?
On the scene.
Huh. Hi, Ed.
The Deadheads started filling up the parking lot early, grilling, drinking beer, playing hacky sack, and throwing the frisbee around. They were smoking, making deals, and listening to cassette tapes of past Dead shows. Sounds, smells, and colors swirled in a collage that overwhelmed the senses and appealed to my young hippie sensibilities. Camping wasn't allowed in the parking area, but you wouldn't have known it, with hundreds of tents dotting the horizon as far as the eye could see. I found a few parking attendants, so I asked them what they thought.
We parked about 20,000 just on Sunday. That's before the concert even starts. So that gives you an estimate, it's more than 20,000.
Yeah.
And those are 3 days. And the people that come in the first day are usually pretty good. They don't bother you, and they pretty much do what you tell them to, for the most part.
It's not their fault they're not that bright.
Yeah. A little slow.
It's kind of.
But if you give them specific directions, they're okay.
People tried to sell everything from watermelon slices, beer, Gatorade, cigarettes, tie-dye t-shirts, stickers, flowers, and some other things not found in stores.
50 cents a slice.
50 cents a slice for watermelon.
I gotta make a ticket, man.
Some hippies in an old school bus with a makeshift kitchen served questionable falafel to hungry partiers. The smell of Middle Eastern spices mingled with sweat, patchouli, marijuana, and the surrounding pine woods. It was like a psychedelic tailgate party. Finally, the time came for the main event, and the tranquil vibe spilled onto the hill, flowing to the stage. The band kicked off with Hell in a Bucket, and then wove their way through Althea, Deal, Terrapin Station, and Morning Dew. Eventually, the Grateful Dead scene became too much to manage and brought the annual gathering to an end. But for a decade, deadheads came from all over the country to camp in the woods and experience the band's vision of love, sharing, and peaceful coexistence. And we got to hear them play songs fit for a hippie utopia on a hillside near the rolling farm fields of southeastern Wisconsin.
Steve Gotcher is a producer and technical director at Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And Wisconsin Life is part of our weekly edition of Wisconsin Weekend here on The Morning Show. And now we turn to the U.S. Supreme Court and a ruling on partisan gerrymandering. In a 5-4 decision yesterday, the court ruled that partisan gerrymandering fell beyond the reach of the federal courts. Democratic Governor Tony Evers called the ruling devastating for democracy, while Republican lawmakers, they hailed the decision as affirmation of election maps they drew after the 2010 census. Democrats and Republicans have been fighting in court for years over the maps, and now their legal battles could be over. Do you agree with the Supreme Court's decision yesterday? Are you concerned, upset? Have you been affected by partisan gerrymandering in past elections? Has it changed your view of democracy? Join in at 800-642-1234. Jolly Emery is department chair and associate professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. Jolly, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So what exactly does this new ruling mean for Wisconsin's legal battles over partisan gerrymandering?
Sure. So last year, the Supreme Court looked at a case coming from the state of Wisconsin. And in that instance, it was also partisan gerrymandering. But the case was sent back to Wisconsin because the parties didn't have what's called standing. That is, that they weren't personally injured. And so they weren't affected by the way the district lines have been drawn.
And this is Gill versus Whitford we're talking about.
Okay. Yes, it is. And that was a 9-0 ruling. All the justices agreed that the parties haven't demonstrated standing, and that's a requirement in order to get a legal remedy. Now, the court has said, the majority have said, we are not going to address partisan gerrymandering. And so this is what they call a political question. And political questions are best addressed by elected bodies or legislatures. And that this is outside of the reach, as you said, of federal courts. So with respect to Wisconsin and its claim, it's going to have a lot of problems. The Democrats in Wisconsin are going to have a lot of problems trying to get the court to look at partisan gerrymandering in this state.
So does that mean the lawsuits, they all have to go away? Could any continue?
So there's a little bit of language in the majority decision that was written by Justice Roberts that basically says if you can demonstrate that, in layman's terms, this is so egregious that you have this equal protection violation, then, you know, perhaps we can address it. But there's really very little room left by majority to make these claims. The biggest issue, I think, for Roberts in this case, running for majority, is that there's nothing in the Constitution that requires that you have what's called proportional representation. And so how can you make an argument or how can the court somehow require states to create what's fairness, and how you define fairness when it comes to parties being able to have representation in their state legislatures or in Congress?
We're discussing yesterday's long-awaited ruling on partisan gerrymandering by the U.S. Supreme Court. Jolly Emery is our guide. She's an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. What questions or comments do you have about the U.S. Supreme Court decision? Join in at 800-642-1234. Jolly, how long have Democrats and Republicans in Wisconsin been fighting over the maps drawn by Republicans? Where does this history go?
Okay, so with respect to the current maps, the map was drawn after 2010, so 2011. And so it's been around almost 10 years now. And obviously Wisconsin isn't the only state that is concerned about partisan gerrymandering. We have so many different challenges that are being brought up through the courts. But again, Getting these challenges addressed based on partisan gerrymandering is going to be very difficult because of yesterday's ruling.
So did the court draw on past rulings to explain its position? What type of explanation do we have?
Yeah, so the court did draw on past rulings. The court has said before that it doesn't want to address partisan gerrymandering. And with respect to the legal reasoning here, as I said before, what Roberts is really relying on, the majority really relying on, is that you don't have any constitutional protection when it comes to parties and the distribution of parties and the distribution of districts within a state or with respect to proportional representation in Congress. So that for them is the sticking issue, this whole idea of partisanship.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and districts lines are drawn by legislatures. And so historically, this is, you know, how the process is done. And obviously, if one party is in power, that party is going to want to draw legislative districts, whether it's for the state legislature or for Congress, to benefit its party. Its party's goals are to get people elected to office. And so it's, you know, telling, and it's not uncommon that the court took two cases this time, one coming from the state of North Carolina, where you have Democrats that are concerned about how Republicans redraw in congressional districts, and then you have Maryland, where Republicans are concerned about how a Democratic congressional district was redrawn there. So it just, I think, illustrates very clearly that who's in control in a state legislature matters, which party's in control matters, and they're going to draw those lines to benefit themselves. But the court says, you know, we can't come up with a rule with respect to fairness. We can't come up with some sort of equation that says this equals fairness when it comes to parties and getting people elected to office.
Jolly, this was a really close ruling. What did the liberal justices who opposed it say about their positions?
Sure. So Justice Kagan, in her dissent, she was pretty pointed, and she said, this is the most important right you have in a democracy, the right to vote, and that with respect to the way that some of these district lines are being drawn, it is a debasement of people's right to vote. And that language comes from the first case that the court took looking at and decided that you could bring political questions on reapportionment to federal courts. That's Baker v. Carr in 1962, where they talked about how it was debasement when you draw these district lines or don't redraw these district lines and people, their right to vote is basically diluted. But she's trying to make this argument here, and she's just very concerned, as are the other liberal justices.
And we have to pause right there with Jolly Emery, a political scientist at UW-Whitewater. How do you think lawmakers should respond to the Supreme Court's ruling on partisan gerrymandering? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the High Court ruling that federal courts can't strike down partisan gerrymandering. The decision effectively ends a Wisconsin case that challenged election maps drawn by Republicans in 2011. Sachin Chetta directs the Fair Elections Project, which helped organize Wisconsin's lawsuit, and he says voters want to see changes to how maps are drawn.
And so we're going to keep using the legislative and political processes to change how districts are drawn, so we can have fair elections again in Wisconsin and across the country.
What questions do you have about the Supreme Court ruling? Join in 800-642-1234. UW-Whitewater political scientist Jolly Emery stays with us. She's our guide. Let's go to the phones now with Mike joining us from Madison. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. So I think that this is proof beyond a reasonable doubt that they, the government, are corrupt and no longer care about we, the people. When they, the government, choose to side with corrupt politicians over the freedoms of Americans, especially in relating to voting, something that we are currently fighting with other countries around the world to get them to allow free elections, and we won't even allow free elections in our own country, I think this is horrible, especially with Independence Day only a few days away when we celebrate we the people standing up against they, a corrupt government. Something needs to be done about this now. We can no longer trust our federal judiciary.
Mike, thanks for the call. Jolly Emery, do you find that this is an impact on democracy? What does it say here?
Sure. So what Micah's had to say just reminds me a lot of what Justice Kagan had to say in her dissent, because Justice Kagan said, you know, the people empower the government. And so if you say that there is no way for people to bring this issue to the federal courts for any kind of remedy, then what you're doing is, you know, basically stripping the people of their opportunity to get some sort of solution, because there's no incentive on the part of a legislature to create some commission if they are able to draw those district lines to benefit themselves. Why would you do that?
Let's take another call. Let's go to Sean joining us from Burlington now. Hi, Sean.
Hi. Yeah, our votes don't matter. You got people who win an election in 2010 and then they get to rule for 10 years. And now the Supreme Court, with the political hacks that are on the Supreme Court, come in and say that our Constitution doesn't guarantee us a right to a representative democracy. It's absurd. I have no faith in the Supreme Court, in our supposed representatives. Or the fact that we even have what's called a republic anymore. It's just absurd. I don't know what to think anymore, and I will not be celebrating on July 4th this year. I just don't have anything to celebrate anymore.
Hey, Sean, and I want to go to this email as well from Bill from Green Lake, who asked that question. Why does the Constitution require a census if not to ensure proportional representation? Jolly?
So the census is with regard to count, right? And the census has to do with representation in the House, and so the House of Representatives. And so it's about redistributing those seats if you have significant population change. But that's a fair question. I think one of the things to think about, if you kind of step back even further, right? Again, going back to these consolidated cases, both parties engage in this kind of behavior when they can. So both parties, major parties, I should say, want to make sure that they can, as much as possible, guarantee outcomes for people in their party. And that makes sense. There's an incentive to do that. I think, on the other hand, you know, what we kind of forget about is we focus on the major parties, and we don't even think how this affects minor parties, right? There's just no way for minor parties or third parties to have an opportunity to win under this system. But, you know, these are all important questions, for sure.
So does the Supreme Court's ruling mean then Wisconsin's current election maps will be used in the 2020 elections, next year's elections?
Oh, yeah, sure.
So,
and then there'll be another census, and then there'll be another opportunity to look at the districts and, you know, reapportion.
So Wisconsin's election maps will be redrawn after the 2020 census. Is there a chance that yesterday's ruling could be good for Democrats? Could they take control of the state legislature next year, perhaps, and then draw their own maps to their own advantage?
So that is a possibility, right? I don't know how likely that is. Again, part of the problem has to do with the way the districts are drawn, that you create these safe seats, so to speak, for Republicans, and that's a concern on the part of Democrats in the state of Wisconsin in certain districts. But, you know, I think what the majority were getting at in their ruling is that your right to vote is protected, but you don't have a right to an outcome. And yeah, fair enough, except that if you can never get the outcome you want, how is your right protected? And that's kind of what the dissenters are arguing.
So does the ruling open any doors to other forms of gerrymandering, like involving the racial or gender demographics of voters?
So racial gerrymandering has already been something that the Supreme Court has addressed. There had been attempts, particularly during the 80s, to create what are called majority-minority districts so that you would be able to get minority candidates elected more easily. And so the district lines were redrawn in a way that you had, you know, a majority of minorities within those districts. But the Supreme Court has looked at those and said that those are an equal protection violation because they're drawn based upon race. And that's clearly a violation of the Equal Protection Clause. So one of the things that the court will look at still with regard to reapportionment is how the lines are drawn. If you have really funky looking district lines that are obviously trying to benefit either someone by race or gender or by even in instances party and they're just really strange looking lines, district lines, then you can bring a challenge. If you have in a case where you have malapportionment, that is where one district is drawn in such a way that there are, you know, lots and lots of people, like in an urban area, and then another district is drawn in a way where you have a much smaller population, then you have, you know, problems with regard to representation. And so those challenges are brought. And those are the first types of challenges that were brought to the court with regard to malapportionment.
Let's fit in one more call here. Jimmy in Valley Junction. Hi, Jimmy.
Morning, morning. Yeah, I would just point out that I'm sure if the Democrats had were in power totally, they might have done the same thing. Look at the situation in Maryland, which I understand was probably gerrymandered versus Wisconsin by the Democrats. So when they get when the Democratic Party gets back in power, they need to remember this and enact legislation or a constitutional amendment to change the way it's done to some kind of a nonpartisan commission or something that's fair that they think, instead of turning around and doing the same thing the Republicans did after 2010. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Jimmy, thanks. And Jolly, is there any momentum on that toward a nonpartisan commission or anything like that in other states and in Wisconsin?
I don't know. I would assume that there's probably something along those lines, but I can't tell you.
Has there been any momentum, though, in Congress or in Wisconsin's legislature to take action on partisan gerrymandering? Is this something the legislature even has an appetite to take up?
I'm sure that there are some legislators, particularly Democrats, who would like to take this up. But it's, again, you know, based upon the composition of the legislature, it's something that's going to be very hard to get passed. And then I think Democrats are also aware that if you pass this, then you're not going to have that same opportunity once you hold the majority.
Really quick here, you know, and touch on another Supreme Court ruling yesterday. The court rejected President Trump's argument for including a citizenship question in next year's census. What could that ruling mean for future elections in Wisconsin?
In terms of a census question? That's a good question. I don't know exactly how to answer that, except that one of the concerns with respect to that citizenship question was that it can affect federal dollars. It can also affect, you know, the redrawing of district lines, too, because if you have people who are afraid to answer that question and you have inaccurate counts, and this is one of the arguments with respect to the question, if the counts are inaccurate, then some states can be hurt because you're not really measuring their population correctly. And when it comes to redrawing those district lines for the House of Representatives, then those folks could lose out because, you know, it's set at 435. The other issue is with respect to federal funding. So if there's an undercount because people don't want to be identified as non-citizens, then states can lose money.
Yeah, impact states. Yeah. Jolly, thanks for joining us.
Sure.
Jolly Emery is an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.